people. I want to advise the parties that Justice Bender is not participating in this case. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. Eric Sandler on behalf of Ms. Rodriguez. I guess one benefit of being so close, I can actually see everybody. 1610-402, which sets out specific procedures to be followed if closed circuit television is to be used in the presentation of the testimony of a child victim. According to that statute, the child witness should be placed in a room other than the courtroom, the prosecutor, defense attorney, operators of the closed circuit equipment, and if appropriate, the GAL would also be present in that room. In fact, the statute seems to say that the jury can be in that room too, but that would present its own problems, but we're not here on that. The defendant's supposed to remain in the courtroom, and both the judge and the defendant should be able to communicate with the persons in the room where the witness is testifying by an appropriate electronic method. And only if the parties agree that the defendant can be removed from the courtroom should the defendant be removed from the courtroom. It can't be disputed that the statute was not followed. Over objection, the child testified in the courtroom, and Ms. Rodriguez was placed in the room other than the courtroom. Ms. Rodriguez was
not. Could I just ask, it wasn't clear to me from reading the briefs, was the discussion immediately going to a different way of doing it?
I'd have to look at the briefs, but I think that they did discuss what was supposed to be done as far as the statute, and the judge says, well, I think this works better.
Okay.
Is how that came up. So I think this works better and this is easier. Ms. Rodriguez was placed in the judge's chambers. There was a video feed into the chambers, but she was not provided with any appropriate electronic method of communication with counsel. All of those procedures were objected to. When counsel said he would not be able to communicate with his client and presents serious constitutional issues, the court said, well, you could stop the proceedings and go talk to her. When counsel expressed concerns about that, the judge then said, well, you can go observe the proceedings with your client as well. Given those quote-unquote choices, counsel, of course, chose to remain in the courtroom. The Court of Appeals found a statutory violation, and while the court said it was not reaching the issue of whether a constitutional violation occurred, they did appear to analyze the issue as one of confrontation and the right to be present, applied a constitutional harmless error test, and found any error harmless.
Now, you're not challenging that the child victim can be separated from the alleged perpetrator, or in this case, someone who helped the perpetrator.
Am I challenging that, whether the statute itself is constitutional? I think that's the issue before the court. Whether or not I think it is or is not an issue that I'm saying is okay, but I'm not challenging it here.
You're trying to elevate the statutory to some kind of a constitutional level?
Well, what happened here? It's not the fact of the matter is it's not. I'm not challenging the statute, the constitutionality of the statute whatsoever. What I'm challenging here is the fact that Ms. Rodriguez was placed in a room, was not able to participate whatsoever when this was going on. She was placed in a room observing it, was there therefore not a participant in the trial whatsoever, and that is a constitutional violation.
And she had no way to contact her counsel.
Well, the only way she was not. What the court said was, well, attorney, you can go stop the proceedings and go talk to your client. Well, the problem, of course, with that is that the Sixth Amendment doesn't give the attorney the right to go talk with the client. It gives the defendant the right to talk to the attorney. Problem number one. Problem number two, even if she wanted to, the only way for her to do that was to talk to the sheriff who was standing there observing the whole proceedings and say, hey, I want to go talk to my attorney. And that presents its own subset of problems. So here you have a state actor sitting there, and she has to go through the state actor in order to have any sort of communication whatsoever with her attorney. And I think the Florida court in Miles v. State, and I've discussed that issue, the problems with that, and I want to get there because I think there's a good quote that they use here. And not only did they say that would infringe upon a privacy of attorney-client communication, the court said, and I quote, "No one would seriously propose, for example, that an incarcerated defendant be required to communicate with counsel only indirectly during trial preparation in an oral relay system in which the prison employees are the medium," which is precisely what would have had to happen here. She would have had to say, "Mr. Sheriff, I need to go talk to my attorney about this." And not only that, what we have here is that by the time she wants to talk to her attorney, proceedings are going forward. Whatever she needed to talk to him about has already passed and has already happened. So what we're missing is a method of contemporaneous communication with counsel.
So I just want a little clarity on something. Since you say you're not challenging the Constitution under the statute, and do I understand you correctly that issue here is the variance between how this was handled and the statute and the constitutionality of that variance? Is that correct?
Well, partly. You know, the constitutionality of the statute was never challenged below, so I'm not in a position to be up here challenging whether or not it is constitutional. What I'm saying is that the very minimum, if the statute is to be deemed constitutional, then the procedures there have to be followed. They weren't. And the violations there...
Your challenge is broader than you're then saying, you're sort of ignoring the statute, saying we don't have to address it, and just saying this is unconstitutional for...
Well, the procedures used were unconstitutional. What's before this court is the procedures that were used in this case, regardless of whether or not they were provided for by statute or not provided for by statute. What's before this court is whether or not the procedures used to present the testimony and the procedures used in separating Ms. Rodriguez and not providing her access to counsel was constitutional, regardless of whether or not there's a statute that provides for it or doesn't provide for it. So the statute, in my opinion, is sort of a red herring. What the court should be looking at is, did the procedures used, did they pass constitutional muster?
Well, but is the only constitutional issue you're raising concerning communication or inability to communicate?
No, because I think the procedures used violated a number of rights protected by the Sixth Amendment. I think it violated the right to effective assistance counsel, and as a subset thereof, the right to access to counsel, the right to participate in one's own defense, the right to be present during the presentation of testimony, I think, as well, the right to be observed by the jury during the presentation of evidence.
So if we agreed with your argument, we would maybe not explicitly, but we would indirectly determine the statute to be unconstitutional, because some of the things that you're addressing are permitted under the statute.
Well,
correct?
If you go all the way, yes, perhaps. But I think the focus here and the biggest problem I have and the biggest problem that this court should be looking at is the fact that Ms. Rodriguez was forced to be an observer of the proceedings. That's the biggest problem, in my view. Whether or not the statute is constitutional under Confrontation Clause analysis, well...
Wouldn't that be true under the statute?
No, that's not, because she would be in the courtroom. She would be provided with an electronic method of communication with her counsel. There was no way of doing that. There was absolutely no way for her to communicate with counsel during the presentation of the evidence.
So it's the communication with counsel, the absence of that deprives her from being present in the courtroom, because it doesn't matter which room that is, but...
Well, it does matter, because I think that one of the subsets there is the right to be observed by the jury during the presentation of evidence. And when you take away the defendant and place her somewhere else, the jury no longer is able to observe that individual.
I understand that, but that's the way it would be under the statute as well, correct? The jury would be with the witness, the judge and the lawyer, the defendant, would be in the courtroom.
Well, the statute seems to provide for that, but quite frankly, I've never seen that happen. I've never heard of anybody I've ever spoken with has ever seen the court say that we're going to put the jury in that room, with the child. And in fact, that kind of defeats the purpose to a certain extent when you're trying to tell the jury that one of the reasons why this child's quote-unquote afraid to testify here is that the whole proceedings are somewhat overwhelming to the child, and talking in front of all these strangers is difficult, and then you have these 12 individuals or 13 individuals in a small room right there with the child. So that presents its own problems. So, but that's not the issue here. The statute itself, the procedures provided for in the statutes, I'm not challenging that. I'm challenging the procedures that were used here. Have I answered the question? Okay. The right of access to counsel and the right to participate in one's own defense are important fundamental rights in and of themselves, but they are also part and parcel of a defendant's right to effective assistance of counsel. The courts have repeatedly held that the government violates the right to effective assistance when it interferes with the ability of counsel to make independent decisions on how to conduct the defense. Of course, in Getters v. United States, the Supreme Court held that a ban on defendant's right to confer with counsel during overnight recesses interfere with the defendant's right to counsel and effective assistance of counsel. Here, the interference was the failure to provide Ms. Rodriguez with a way of privately communicating with counsel during the testimony of the complaining witness. The constitutional guarantee that a defendant has the right to present her case with the aid of counsel does not simply mean the right to have counsel present at the trial, but it also means that a defendant's ability to consult with counsel should not be hindered or obstructed, particularly at a critical moment such as this, when the victim is testifying. The defendant should and must have the absolute freedom to assist counsel in her own defense. That was not allowed here. And we go back to Ferretta v. California, where the United States, when it was talking about the defendant's right to represent him or herself, held that, and I quote, "The Sixth Amendment does not provide merely that a defense shall be made for the accused. It grants to the accused personally the right to make his defense. It is the accused, not counsel, who must be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, who must be confronted with the witnesses against him, and who must be accorded compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor. The right to defend is given directly to the accused, for it is he who suffers the consequences if the defense fails." And here we have that. Have a significant problem with that when she was unable to communicate with counsel, unable to confer with counsel, unable to talk with counsel during the testimony.
Mr. Samuel, can I ask, couch that statement in such absolute terms? Would you be suggesting the same deprivation of a constitutional right if the defendant in a courtroom were not allowed to stop whatever's going on and talk to her counsel anytime she wanted to?
No, but there's a way to do that. There's a way to do that if that's simply by passing a note. No one has to say that the defendant has to stop the proceedings, but at least the defendant can, in that situation, write a note down and say, "We need to talk. I need to talk," or ask this question, or "What about this?" In fact, in Illinois v. Allen, when the defendant was bound and gagged, that was one of the issues that came up, was whether or not the defendant, because the court there said the ability to communicate with counsel is one of the defendant's primary advantages of being present at trial. Now, of course, in Illinois v. Allen, the defendant perhaps brought that upon himself by being obstreperous in court, but here, it's not the situation. Ms. Rodriguez said nothing in the courtroom to say that she should be.
Okay, I guess part of what I'm concerned about is just trying to figure out how often and how easy the access has to be in order for us to have a constitutional violation in your understanding. Client were unable to contact counsel because he's asking questions and it would take 5 minutes. Surely that doesn't drive. If counsel in this scenario could have interrupted whatever his pleasure was, gone to find out if his client had anything to communicate with him, would that be that seems to have been permissible here. That's not satisfactory.
No, it's not, because, again, it's the defendant's Sixth Amendment right. It's not the council's Sixth Amendment right. The council, the defendant has the right to confer with her attorney. Not necessarily the attorney has the right or the constitutional right to confer with client. You know, in fact, not to be glib, but sometimes it would be a heck of a lot easier to practice law if we didn't have to confer with clients in certain things. But the fact of the matter is, the client has certain constitutional rights, and that right includes the right to confer with counsel. And when there's a court order put in place that basically prohibits that, I think the line can be drawn there.
So, from your point of view, that has primarily to do with who can initiate the contact, how much delay there has to be before they can initiate the contact?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily so. The problem we have here, you know, if you want to put it in concrete terms of what would have happened here, she would have had to pass a note to a sheriff, to a law enforcement, to an actor of the state to say, I want to talk to my attorney. And by that time, that A, we don't even know under this situation whether or not the court would have allowed that, because the court did not give her the right to do that. The court gave counsel the right to stop the proceedings, not Ms. Rodriguez the right to stop the proceedings. Secondly, then you have the whole problem of having to go through the state in order to confer with counsel. And then you, so that's another issue that you have here.
Well, remind me what the Court of Appeals did. They said there was a violation of the statute.
They said there was a violation of the statute. They didn't really seem to analyze it as a right of access. They said, well, we're gonna say we don't need to, because even if it is a constitutional violation, you know, it's harmless error. It's constitutional harmless error.
Am I the record as to the evidence, the overwhelming evidence of guilt?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that whatsoever. But they just said it was constitutional harmless error. But that's another one of the issues that's before this court, is when you have a Sixth Amendment violation of this sort, when you have a Sixth Amendment violation that infringes upon a defendant's right to counsel and access to counsel, what error is applicable? Is that structural error? Is that trial error?
I understand, sir. Proceed, would you?
Okay.
Why does it require a new trial per se?
Well, it requires a new trial per se because it's structural error, plain and simple. And there's a couple of reasons why I believe that. When the Supreme Court has analyzed Sixth Amendment violations under a trial error analysis, they've always done so when those Sixth Amendment violations result in evidentiary violations. In other words, the Sixth Amendment violations result in evidence being admitted that should not have been admitted. There has never been a case that I've found, at least when I look at Getters, for example, which is another one where the access to counsel was denied. The court did not say, well, we're going to sit down there and figure out whether or not there was evidence that was overwhelming or not. They said that's structural error, plain and simple, because we can't even begin to analyze what the difference would have occurred. Over and above that, there are certain fundamental rights that are so fundamental, such as the access to counsel, when there's an interference with it, they need to be analyzed as structural error. I'm going to actually quote Satterwhite v. Texas when they said that we have permitted harmless error analysis in both capital and non-capital cases where the evil caused by a Sixth Amendment violation is limited to the erroneous admission of particular evidence at trial. But here we're not talking about an evidentiary issue whatsoever. What we're talking about is how the trial proceeded, with regard to the presentation of this witness's testimony.
Can I ask you a question about mm-hmm. that? The case that the Colorado Court of Appeals seems to be relying upon in making that distinction is one of ours. It's called Arteaga Lanzas.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to hear exactly that they found that
what happened in that case?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't look at it. I'm just wondering.
I'm not sure if they found that.
They said that it seems, at least, that they're saying it's just plain and simply that confrontation clause violations are
trial, there's not a strike.
Well, this isn't a confrontation clause. The problem here is that we're not talking about a confrontation clause. You know, when you're talking about a confrontation clause violation, what you're necessarily talking about is an evidentiary issue. And then evidentiary issues can be analyzed under a constitutional harmless error standard because the court can simply say, okay, we're going to excise that evidence. If that evidence wasn't permitted, we're going to look at the rest of the record and see whether looking at the rest of that record, whether the presentation of that evidence was...
Now, Mr. Chandler, I'm sorry. I guess I'm getting back to those execution questions that Justice Martinez asked you. So this is really a confrontation clause plus more, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is it's a Sixth Amendment violation. That Sixth Amendment violation is because the Sixth Amendment doesn't obviously just deal with confrontation. It deals with the right to counsel. It deals with the right of access to counsel. It deals with the right of effective representation of counsel. And I think that the confrontation problems are here. But I think the main issue and the main focus should be here is on the denial of the access to counsel.
So any infringement on that is structural.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say any infringement because I think in Perry v. League, which came out after Getters, which was a five minute recess, and there was a 5 minute recess between when the defendant was actually testifying, and the court said you can't talk to your attorney. The court said that wasn't even error. Now, not that it was structural error. That wasn't even error. That was okay. The court had the power to do that, but of course, in that situation, we have a different thing. The defendant there is testifying. The issue there is whether or not the defendant will be coached in his testimony. We certainly don't have that issue here because the defendant wasn't testifying.
So what about the not letting the defendant talk to his counsel overnight? That was structural error?
That was structural error.
And is there something in between that structural error that helps the defendant and before she fell? I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out the essence of what you're saying here is that during a period of time that the child had only a cumbersome way of being able to talk to his lawyer, her lawyer, which she mentioned.
Well,
she had this way. She could tell the sheriff to stop the trial.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that was so cumbersome as to effectively the denial of that right?
Well, no, there was an interference with that right because the state was involved in that regardless. And secondly, she wasn't given that right. That right was given to counsel. And thirdly, that would presume a waiver of the Sixth Amendment right from the silent record. And I think in the supplemental authority that I did file, I had the Martin v. U.S. case, which is a case out of the District of Columbia, which talk about whether or not you can say that there's a waiver of the right to counsel because it wasn't asserted. And as the court said, for a waiver to be valid, it must be an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right or privilege. And it can't be presumed from a silent record, especially so when we have a situation here where there's a court order that seems to prevent that. And then once again, you're saying that, well, she waived that right because there's a court order that prevents access to counsel, and she didn't initiate it. And this U.S. Supreme Court as well, Brewer v. William, which is a case I believe is out of the 1970s, which held that the right to counsel does not depend upon a request by the defendant. The courts must indulge in every reasonable presumption against waiver. So I don't think there can be, from a silent record, that she waived her right to counsel, waived her right to want to speak with counsel simply because she didn't or she couldn't or because counsel didn't initiate any breaks and just went ahead with cross-examination without stopping the proceedings.
Sandler, if we're kind of perhaps bringing the discussion of structural error to a conclusion, could you assume for a moment that, obviously we've concluded structural error, that's the end of the analysis, but if we do not, then we have to examine prejudice.
Well, the problem with that, in my mind, is how do you do that? How do you do that with not necessarily getting into the attorney-client privilege? How do you do that without saying, okay, what did you discuss with your counsel? What would you have discussed with your counsel? What defenses would you have raised? Because there's nothing there for the court to do. So that necessarily causes its own set of problems.
So I understand that that's actually the punishment for why it's considered structural error.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if we do not consider structural error, And I understand what you just said, there's a problem with how you consider prejudice, but how would you do that? How would you guide us if we want to include this trial or non-structural?
I don't have an answer to that, and I'll tell you why. Because the court, I do not know, and I cannot know, what evidence would or would not have been presented. I simply cannot know that.
Yes, but in all kinds of cases, we look at prejudice based on the evidence or proof or something like that.
I don't know how there could be an offer of proof of what would have been talked about between counsel. Because the issue here is whether or not the defendant had the right to.
The guilt and the evidence are overwhelming.
No, the guilt and the evidence aren't overwhelming.
Tell me why not.
Okay. The issue here, whether or not the facts happened, okay, we're not disputing. That was never a dispute in trial. The question is whether or not there was a duress defense, whether or not, in fact, Ms. Rodriguez had no choice in the matter of what occurred, whether or not. You know, obviously, we know that the jury did not.
But the duress defense was presented to the jury.
Well, yes,
and there was all kinds of evidence about the perpetrator's coercion, let's say, if that's
correct. Well, we can jump right into then the judicial bias argument. We can jump right into other issues here, which I think affect whether or not how that evidence was presented and how.
Could you talk about the judicial bias? That's okay with Justice.
That's fine.
Okay, sure. We're not disputing that the trial judge has the right to ask questions, but when the judge does, the judge needs to make certain that he or she is not acting as an advocate for the prosecution, and that is precisely what occurred here. All of the questions posed by the judge were as an advocate for the people. The questions to the officer as to what he meant by a certain word, what he meant by smother, did he mean that Ms. Rodriguez was trying to harm Ms. Rodriguez or just trying to stop her from screaming? Limitations on the testimony of Dr. McKish, for example, as well, when he refused the whole avenue of questioning because it, quote unquote, would open up a whole new area and thus presumably lengthen the trial, when that issue there was the ultimate fact of duress. With the quote-unquote wallowing minutia comment, and I understand that was directed at both counsel, but its intent was to stop Ms. Rodriguez's whole area of inquiry to whether the curtains and shades in the house were still drawn at the house days and I believe even weeks afterwards, because after Ms. Rodriguez had been arrested, thus demonstrating Ms. Rodriguez's continuing fear of Mr. Rodriguez, even though he was arrested in jail. The testimony of Dr. Pinto, the defense expert, after the redirect, the court clearly continued on with the prosecutor's line of questioning, not an attempt to clarify something, but rather an attempt to prove the prosecutor's case. The court asked what can only be characterized as a classic prosecution question. Was Ms. Rodriguez remorseful for what had happened, or really only remorseful because she was arrested? What that had to do with anything as far as that, I thought, sure. And then she started asking specific questions about duress and raises this hypothetical regarding Ms. Rodriguez being, quote unquote, ordered to go shoot people, and if she didn't do something, would something happen to the children? Would she still find duress when first, duress isn't a defense to a felony, one. And secondly, what he's in essence saying is that Ms. Rodriguez, compare Ms. Rodriguez to a mass murderer. And then he adopted the people's theory of the case that the abuse was worse at the beginning, and then asked whether Ms. Rodriguez unreasonably put herself in this position by not leaving earlier. And from the tenor of questions, one thing becomes clear: the court's not asking questions to clarify or elicit relevant material facts, but it's trying the case for the people by asking questions that both adopt and promote the people's theory. Not one of the questions asked was to elicit actual facts or any sort of facts that might have been in dispute, might have been questionable, but isn't the people's theory of the case correct? And both the Court of Appeals and I think the people too missed the point when they say already that the answers given did not harm Ms. Rodriguez, because it's a fundamental right to be tried before an impartial judge, and that in and of itself is structural error. It's structural error. Any questions at this point? I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Gillespie. I'm here on behalf of the people. My registration number is 26109. Justice Hobbs, I'm going to take you up on your offer to explain why this should be considered trial error and why in this particular case it was harmless. This was not a typical child victim of a sex assault case. Normally in these cases we see he said, she said cases where basically the crux of the case is the credibility of the child. That wasn't the case here. This child admitted, and the mom admitted, the defendant here admitted by her affirmative defense of duress, that the sex assaults took place. This child's testimony or her credibility was not challenged by the defense. She provided ample evidence during her testimony to support the theory of duress. She described how her mother was treated by the husband, what physical violence she saw, how her mother reacted when she was being when the daughter was being sexually abused. So I think it is crucial in this case that this testimony of the child was not being challenged. In fact, on cross-examination, defense attorney focused specifically on the duress defense and didn't even ask the child any specifics about the acts of sexual abuse that she suffered. In addition, yes, sir.
The fact that this credibility of the witness, of the child as to whether these acts occurred, was not an issue, does not seem to me to be persuasive that this was not a critical witness in the case. That is, wasn't this the primary witness with respect to the conduct of the mother and the behavior of the mother, all of which goes to whether she was under duress or not?
It was, but all of the testimony that the child gave on that point supported the mother's theory. So it wasn't a case of the child being...
Isn't that a matter of degree?
It is.
Because essentially, if I understand this case, I don't think there was a difference between the people, obviously, whether the conduct occurred or whether the defendant was an extraordinarily abused woman. The issue was whether the condition that she was in and what she was subject to was so severe as to justify conduct under duress theory.
Correct. And I think on that, and I would agree with you.
The issue is the severity of the conduct and the severity of her and the nature of her reactions to it.
And the child, during her testimony, did have some information on that, but it was very vague and very general. She did not have a lot of information, was not an eyewitness to a lot of the abuse that her mother allegedly suffered, in this case, at the hands of Mr. Rodriguez.
She was a witness to her mother's conduct in making her available to
She was, but that was confessed by the affirmative defense. I mean, in order to raise...
She did it, in the essence of her duress, right?
Correct. And the child did give testimony that the mother appeared to be sad and apologized on certain occasions for what was going on. But it's not your typical child sex assault case where the cross-examination of this child is critical. And when you look at...
That's where I'm disagreeing. It seems to me that what you're really saying, it's not a typical child abuse case, and I don't know why that's relevant at all, where it's not critical as to whether the act occurred or not, but it's certainly critical as to whether the mother was acting under duress or not. So the primary witness with respect to her behavior at the time she was making the child available.
At the time she was making the child available, that's correct. But, no, I don't. I think there was testimony from one other, I think the son? For different acts of sexual assault, not for the child, not for the daughters. But the daughter did not have a lot of information about, she did have information about how the sexual assaults took place and what her mother's demeanor was during those sexual assaults. What she did not have a lot of critical eyewitness testimony to was the degree of abuse that the victim, that Ms. Rodriguez suffered at the hands of her husband. So I don't think that the testimony was as critical as you're implying.
But isn't that one of those things we'll never know?
No, obviously.
Exactly, because we can't have the defense saying, well, this is what what I told my mother, or what I would have told my mother if I could have communicated.
No, that's correct. What I'm arguing is that under a harmless error analysis, you have to look at the context and the significance of the violation that took place here. And nobody is disputing the fact that the access between the defendant and her attorney was difficult from the other room.
It was nil.
Well, see, I disagree with that too, because the court gave the opportunity and even instructed the jury in this case that they may need to stop the proceedings during the testimony of the child in order for the defense counsel to confer with his client.
They didn't do it.
They never asked to do it. No, that's correct.
I mean, it never happened.
No, it never happened.
Whatever the situation.
And then there was also a break. I'm sorry.
Was it just continuous? Was there a break?
There was a break. Between direct and cross-examination, there was a break. Counsel was able to confer with his client, and when they came back to resume or to begin cross-examination of the child, there was no request for additional time. There was no re-raising of the issue that I'm going to need to be able to have contact with my client. My client's brought this up during our conference, and I need to have access to my client while we're having this cross-examination. In addition to that, there was no request later on in the trial to recall the witness, and there was a preview of the witness's statement because there had been an interviewed videotape of the child. So when you look at some of the cases that I've cited in my brief, where various of these different circuits, and especially the Second Circuit, talks about what you're looking at in the nature and the context and the significance of any potential violation of the right to counsel, those are all things that need to be taken into consideration. And in a lot of these cases, that's what they're going to, is the context of that. Now, will you ever know for sure? And of course not. We don't know what they would have discussed. But when you look at the facts of this case, the very limited nature of the fact that this was one witness, that there was a preview to the videotape or the preview to the testimony, that there was some means of communication given, that there was a break between direct and cross, I think in this particular case that the court can find that harmless error, it was harmless. It just didn't exist in this case.
Minus what the defense of duress is intended to do. I mean, is it an excuse completely? I mean, was there another lesser offense at issue here? What?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of your question.
The defense of duress, what does it do? How does it function in the law?
Well, it's an affirmative defense. So she has admitted that she has committed all the acts that she's charged with, but she's saying that there was a legal reason as to why she shouldn't be held criminally liable for her behavior. And that's why in this particular case, it's a very different case. I think I would have a much harder chance standing up in front of you if this were a child sex assault case where the child's credibility was crucial. It was a he said, she said, and then cross-examination is, in that case, a much more give and take. But as the Yarborough court decided or mentioned in the Second Circuit, they talk about the fact that there is nothing to guarantee that the defendant gets to participate in cross-examination. Now, she may have suggestions for her client, but I think it was Justice Coates brought up, how much does the client get to participate in this? And there's no mention through any of the briefings and in the trial court what she was prevented from discussing.
Yeah, I think one of the difficulties of that is sort of the notion that this is being assessed from the perspective of how could she have influenced the questioning. And you're even suggesting maybe if the witness's testimony and the credibility was an issue, then we might not have any more information, but it might be harder to presume that she couldn't have somehow would have influenced the evidence. I guess I have a little bit of a difficulty with that, primarily because I'm not sure how you could ever assess whether, if there were communication, that would affect the questioning. As Mr. Sandler suggested, I'm not sure how often defendants ever have something really to contribute that's going to affect. Certainly, if the lawyer is well prepared, the client shouldn't be coming up with something at the table that is going to affect the cross-examination. So I guess I'm a little puzzled as to whether the essence of this harmless determination is this kind of guesswork about whether the questioning itself might have been affected.
And I'm not meaning to imply that that would be the essence of it. I think it is a totality of the entire context of this particular case. I don't think that whether or not the defendant would have persuaded the questioning one way or the other is the only thing or the most important thing to look at. I think it is the totality of this case in particular and the nature and the context of this violation that needs to be addressed, and I think all of those factors are important. I think that's one of many things that the court should be looking at. And, you know, I cited People v. Fletcher, which is an Illinois appellate case, which is directly on point to this case. They have the same type of statute that Colorado has, that there should be some means of electronic communication. Doesn't say that it has to be immediate, doesn't say it has to be constant. It just says that there has to be some means of communication. And in that case, it was a 9-year-old testifying by closed circuit TV. And the statute and what they held was there was a violation of the right to counsel because there was not a means of communication. But they looked in that case at the fact that the defendant had confessed to the crimes, had two confessions, that the victim's testimony was cumulative to other information that came out during the trial, and that there was ample evidence of guilt to support the verdict. So I think what I'm arguing to the court is that in this particular case, that is one factor to look at, is the fact that with the facts and the defense that was presented here, and the fact that the child's testimony and her cross-examination supported the defendant, there's not any clear indication that anything big was missed here. Would we ever know for sure? No. But it's, I think you can assess through all of these different factors.
And this just sort of strikes me as the kind of case where the facts aren't really in dispute. Mm-hmm. And what's in dispute is sort of how the jurors are impacted by this horrible, awful situation in terms of whether, how they feel about it ultimately.
Mm-hmm. And whether they believe
because assessing duress seems to me to be a very subjective sort of thing. All of which is sort of illustrated by the trial judge's rhetorical question about how far does this go? Does this permit sniper activity? And so in that context, in the essence of what the jury is grappling with doesn't seem to be confined in any way to the cross-examination. It's kind of the whole feel of the case.
And I would agree with you, and I think
but
that's...
Doesn't that bother you if that's the case with Rodriguez, whether she is responsible or whether she dressed is should have been available to her or not, by both sides, is abused, is oppressed. She has this awful thing about how she retreats to a dark place in her mind when this stuff happens. But this woman is then taken out of the court proceedings. And it seems almost like a further subjection of her to a lower place, essentially. So what I'm sort of trying to get at is, isn't that sort of the feel of this trial in the context of deprivation of the communication and removing her from everyone else's presence? How do you assess that? Does that have some value in trying to assess whether this error is prejudicial?
I think if the court had not instructed the jury, you know, I think if all of a sudden the defendant's removed from the courtroom and the jury doesn't have any indication as to why, then I think that's something that could be of concern, again, considering the entire context. But in this case, the jury was instructed that there's a law in Colorado, that this court's going to take advantage of it. It allows the child to be taken out, or the defendant to be taken outside the courtroom. You can't draw any negative inferences, and we may have to stop the proceedings so that counsel can consult with his attorney. Counsel can consult with the defendant. And so in this particular case, I don't think, you know, one, it's clear from the verdict in this case that they did not believe this woman's duress defense. So while it's difficult sometimes for us to get the feel of the case from just reading the cold record, I think in this case, with the overwhelming verdicts, they didn't buy the duress defense at all. And
that's exactly why this seems to be sort of critical. Because obviously they didn't. But that can't be our primary factor in considering whether this affair is harmless.
No.
Because they didn't, perhaps because of the way this trial was conducted.
Well, I think that again goes back to all the other factors that I talked about as to why having to do with this particular testimony and the...
But should we also consider, you know, there's a separate question concerning the judges, the judge's questioning. Are those proper considerations as far as the first issue, that is the effect, the prejudicial effect of the deprivation of counsel?
No, I don't think so. I think those can be looked at separately. I think when you are looking at whether or not this lack of instantaneous and continuous communication needs to be looked at in how this when the communication was denied and what part of the trial for the length of time it was denied. Was it completely denied? Was she was given access to her attorney over the break? They were given methods by which they could communicate. The jury was instructed. Whether or not her testimony was contentious, all of that looks at whether or not the right to counsel and the inability of this particular defendant to verbally speak with her attorney for a 20-minute period of a multi-day trial.
Mr. Gillespie, can I ask you a question about
yes, sir.
I understood the Court of Appeals opinion, that the Court of Appeals to be saying they didn't feel they needed to address the question of whether this deprivation of instantaneous communication with attorney was statutory or constitutional error, because the Court of Appeals found that even under a constitutional harmless error, this would be harmless. So
right.
Sorry. Given the way you're arguing here, I just wanted to try to pin you down. You've used the term harmless several times in your harmless argument. Are you agreeing with the Court of Appeals that we don't have to reach that question because this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Or does it make a difference whether we apply the statutory harmless or constitutional harmless error standard in your opinion, and therefore we would have to go on and decide whether this is really constitutional error or only statutory error?
My argument is it would not be, I mean, it would be constitutional harmless error. It would meet that standard. Thereby, I don't think that you need to get to the question of whether or not it would be a statutory, since obviously that's
so
a lesser.
You're talking about instantaneous and only a 20-minute deprivation. You didn't mean to be arguing this was not constitutional error. But as you're saying, it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in any event.
It is. Yes, that's correct. And, you know, the Colorado statute's a little unclear on the, it does say a means of communication, but the statute's not clear on exactly what that is going to entail. And again, I think that's because it is going to be set up differently in different courtrooms, major cities versus some of our outlying areas. So I think it is, again, giving the trial court the ability to set his trial into the conditions that are met within that particular case and the facts that are present in their particular case and their setups that are present. I also want to emphasize to the court that if you look through the majority of the cases that are cited by both counsel, including the supplemental authority, all of these cases address this issue as a trial error and not a structural error. And I think the Court of Appeals was correct when it said that the objections at the trial court level were very unclear. And that's why the Court of Appeals addressed it as a federal constitutional error as opposed to a state constitutional error, because actually the Constitution was never brought up in the defendant's objections. He indicated that the counsel indicated that he was concerned about not being able to speak to his client, but didn't go any further and didn't offer really any guidance about the specific concerns that he may have had. And again, after meeting during the break between direct and cross-examination, there was no request for anything additional, no additional time, and no continuing objection that, you know, I can't go forward with this cross-examination without having complete access to the client.
How should we assess the fact that the jury didn't get to see the defendant during this testimony?
Well, most of the right to be present cases, and I think most specifically, Craig dictates that in this particular case, removing the defendant from the courtroom through a closed circuit proceeding is okay when certain procedures are followed, and that the defendant's right to confrontation can give way when there's a compelling state interest. And in this particular case, the court did what it was supposed to do and had a hearing. The child's social worker / therapist testified that it was going to create severe emotional trauma to the child to have to testify in front of her mother, especially sitting in the defendant's position, and that the trauma was going to be extreme. So I think that the procedural aspect, all the way up until the communication issue, was followed the way Craig dictates that. And I explained in my brief why Crawford's not applicable in this particular case.
But in this case, the statute really wouldn't comply with it, because the statute would have called for the the witness being in a different room and hearing by closed circuit television?
It did. And then there's another subsection of that statute that says that unless the parties agree, the defendant can be removed. And all of the cases that I came across in my research, it's pretty unusual. It's usually the defendant that is removed from the courtroom because the defendant wants the jury to be able to see the child firsthand testifying.
In this case, are you saying that the defendant agreed to be removed?
No, he did not. There was no stipulation. So there was, on that particular aspect, there the statute was not complied with.
And how long was this testimony as compared to the entire trial?
You know, Judge, I don't remember specifically. I know that she was one of the shorter witnesses in comparison to some, you know, they had the defense had two experts in this case, and the officers that testified, and then some of the child hearsay that came in. So she definitely was not a significant portion of the trial, and the trial went on for multiple days.
Could you go on to address the conduct of the judge in terms of asking questions?
I can. First, I want to point out for the court that the court is looking at two different standards of review here. The defense in this case asked for a mistrial based on what it perceived to be the trial court's annoyance with defense counsel. But all of the questions that the trial court asked of both the police officer and the defense expert, none of those were objected to by defense counsel. So those are all addressed as plain error. The case law on this particular issue is pretty clear. And I do take issue with the defense counsel's statement that the court can't look at what the answers were to these questions, because what the court has to look at is whether or not the record clearly demonstrates prejudice, and whether or not the questions that the trial court asked so departed from the required impartiality as to deny the defendant a fair trial. So when you look at the record in this case, and I'm not going to try to argue to this court that I think that the questions from this trial judge were completely proper. I think there was some phrasing that was difficult. I think it was extensive, a little more extensive than I certainly have ever seen. However, when you're looking at it under a plain error standard and the fact that these judges' questions directly related back to, as they're required to do, directly related back to the testimony that came through the doctor on direct examination, the questions were trying to get a deeper explanation or to clarify certain points. And as the court pointed out, this duress defense is hard for lay people necessarily to understand, and the court was asking questions to more fully develop.
Isn't that kind of unusual in the adversary system for a judge to take that position? I mean, not for the attorneys. The attorneys were presumably competent here. So isn't the judge putting his thumb here on the scale?
I would agree with you that it is unusual. Yes, sir. But I think when you're looking at it at the plain error and the standard that this court has to look at and whether or not the record demonstrates prejudice as a result of those questions, I don't think that exists. I think that the questions and the answers that were given in this particular case favored the defense. The defense expert stayed strong on her opinion that this woman was acting under duress and could not be held liable for her decisions. And I think most important, and again, I go back to the fact that we're looking at a cold record. It's always difficult to determine how this comes across when you're in the courtroom itself. And I think one thing that speaks volumes about this is that there was no objection. So while in our review of the cold words on the page, it may sound like the trial court was overstepping a bit on the questions, he wasn't overstepping a bit to raise any concern to the DA or to the defense attorney. Nobody made a record about this. Nobody asked to approach the bench to...
Well, we all know how difficult that is.
It is.
And so we have to look at it in a plain air standard. But could you comment on that sniper question? That seems to me to be over the line and denigrated the idea that the duress could be a defense.
The context of it was that the expert had given the opinion that this woman was completely incapable of making any decision to go against what this man had told her to do. And what the trial court asked her was, would your opinion be the same in this particular circumstance? So I think what the court was, I'm assuming what the court was trying to do, was to further delve into, you know, where this duress defense comes from, how much it covers. And like I said, I'm not saying that it was necessarily a smart move on the part of the trial court. But I think when you look at the record as a whole, I don't think that there was any prejudice. When you read through this expert's testimony from beginning to end, this particular statement, although it seems egregious when you take it out of context, in light of all the questions that were asked by defense attorney and the prosecutor during cross, it doesn't stand out the same way. And I don't think it prejudiced the defendant.
Do you think that the question reveals a position or an opinion on the part of the judge?
I don't. No, I think the judge, I think
neutral question.
When he's asking if her opinion would change in this type of factual scenario, yes.
And this was a strong defense expert offered to excuse the conduct. Right? Is that when the question comes up?
I don't understand the court's question.
No, I'm ready for it.
Okay.
This was an expert testifying, but the judge made this remark.
It was.
For the defense.
Correct.
With strong testimony about the coercion and abuse that the mother had suffered.
Correct. Lengthy. A substantial period of time. It was one of two experts, and this particular question was asked at the end of redirect of the expert by defense counsel, and then after these various questions were asked, both defense counsel and the prosecution then continued to delve into this area with the expert before they finished up with the witness. So I would ask the court, if the court doesn't have any more questions, to give the trial courts some guidance on this and to find that this, what I think is the crux of the case, this lack of communication, whether or not it's a violation of the defendant's right to counsel, that it should be reviewed under a harmless error standard. And in this particular case, it was harmless based on the facts. And if the court doesn't have any more questions for me, that's all I have.
I realize I have limited time left, but for those of you who may not have read the record, I feel compelled to say this. For an attorney who's practiced almost 25 years, this was probably the most difficult case I've ever seen. And as far as the amount of abuse both sustained by both Ms. Rodriguez and the children, it was horrific. And that has to be kept in mind, not just because of what happened to the children, and my heart goes out, but also what happened to Ms. Rodriguez and the abuse that she suffered for a period of 20 years. So that, I think, needed to be said. The other thing with regard to whether or not any of those cases dealt with structural error that were cited, I think a number of them did. I think what you need to look at, I think if you look at U.S. v. Chronic, footnote 25 especially, where the court stated, quote, the court has uniformly found constitutional error without any showing of prejudice when counsel was either totally absent or prevented from assisting the accused during a critical stage of the proceeding.
And what you just said about the abuse over 20 years and the situation the mother was placed in, the jury heard, right? And under our system, these citizens get the, well, make the ultimate decision.
Well, they did hear, but would they have heard more? Would they have heard more with regard to what would have happened with regard to what the child would have testified to? Because obviously we're dealing with, you know, the child testified to a significant amount, but the child could have testified to more. And if Ms. Rodriguez was in a position to be able to say, well, ask her this, we'll ask her this, then that could have been brought out even more.
But the defense attorney has some responsibility in this to bring out the more. Right.
Well, the defense has a responsibility, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not the client has the right. The issue is whether or not the defendant has a constitutional right of access to counsel.
But the issue is whether there's a fair trial.
I am asking for a new trial. But the issue is whether or not, you know, I'm sort of reminded of Justice Scalia's comment. I think it was in Crawford that even a guilty person is entitled to a jury trial. You know, so there's certain rights that are so fundamental in our system that we can't just run roughshod over. And it was run roughshod over here. And it was run roughshod because the judge thought it would be more expedient to do it this way. And this court needs to remember as well that this trial took place right here in Denver. And so there should have been something set up so it could have happened. This wasn't in some far-flung place, someplace that maybe they didn't have the ability or the money or the equipment to do so. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.